This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
War Stories, Episode 1, Gallipoli. At the beginning of the year 1914, the British Dominion of New Zealand exists largely unnoticed on the edge of the Pacific Rim. It is a small country of just over 1 million people. It has no peacetime army and is geographically as far away from Europe as it is possible to be. Yet when Great Britain declares war on Germany on the 4th of August of that year, New Zealand quickly follows suit. For some young men, like 23-year-old Southland farmer Will Anderson, enlisting is an act of patriotism. He does not yet know that he will live with this war until the day he dies.
John and I had taken over the farm after our father's sudden death. It had been hard work until Robin Calder left school and joined us. We had thought that things would get moving then, but this news changed everything.
Like all the young men in the country at that time, Will was a territorial soldier, spending several weeks a year in drills and at camp. His most recent had been at the end of April, at Matarai, near Oamaru.
There were thousands of men camped at Mortaday. For 2 weeks we skirmished and skylarked and were force marched up hills and told what to do. I even managed to get killed once. It was a good chance to catch up with people we knew, and it was time away from the hard physical work we did every day. On our last night, my brother Rob and I watched the big guns firing and shells bursting in the night sky. 4 days later, we were back home spreading lime in the rain and digging boxes out of drains.
For several Otago University students, the camp was a way of earning money by arriving early and helping set up. It then became an exercise in how to avoid doing anything remotely like soldiering.
Our strong points were the formation of rear guards, winning forced marches home and marching at ease, manoeuvres which gave us considerable scope to display our initiative and resource. Our return to the sequestered halls of learning soon dispelled any cherished illusions as to the glory of war.
On the 24th of August, barely 3 weeks after he had read that newspaper headline on the train, Will Anderson cycled the 10 kilometres into Riverton and caught the train north. The Otago Battalion was camped just outside Dunedin at Tahuna Park. Each day, more men arrived to begin the transition from territorial to regular army. In Port Chalmers, carpenters were at work converting the SS Ruapehu from a liner into a troop ship. At the beginning of October, the Ruapehu left for Wellington, carrying 784 men and 244 horses. These were heady days. Everywhere they went, the soldiers were given gifts and publicly admired for doing their patriotic duty. Their commanders, however, knew the men were underprepared and did all they could to bolster their skills.
We were an army of civilians training for something none of us could imagine. Every day we would march to places like Karori Beach to learn how to find the enemy and centre our fire. They instructed us in the use of the bayonet, and we aimed our rifles at targets that were the head and shoulders of men, and told ourselves it would never come to this. Living as we did in such close proximity to one another, we became mates with people we wouldn't normally know, and that made things easier, though the waiting was hard. Despite the fine speeches and articles in the newspapers, none of us knew what was ahead, and for some it became too much. There were black eyes and cut lips. But all that died down when the horses were brought in from the camps and embarkation began. Loading up the stores was the first manual labour I'd done since leaving home, and I can tell you, it was a welcome change from drill. We left Wellington Harbour on the 16th of October 1914, the Ruapehu being second last in the long line of ships. Looking southward, I saw the mountains and the bush. Soon that disappeared and we were on our way.
The 12 ships from New Zealand stopped at Hobart, and again at Albany in Western Australia, where they were joined by a large number of Australian troop ships. The feeling of patriotic optimism on board continued well into the Indian Ocean, where eventually the heat and cramped living quarters sapped enthusiasm and resulted in insubordination and complaints about food. The men had been in the army waiting to fight for well over 3 months, and when they were told to stay in Egypt and fight the Turks, most of them were more than ready to get off the ships and get on with it. The New Zealand camp was set up at Zeytun, on the outskirts of Cairo, and the troops resumed marching long distances and performing the same drills they had practiced at home. 7 weeks at sea with little to do except think about what was to come had made Will Anderson cynical.
Advancing over wide open desert spaces again made me wonder how we were going to get there against the mass release of machine gun bullets. It seemed to me that men were as expendable as ammunition, and those that in charge believed the ends justified the means.
On Boxing Day, 1914, the men were sent to guard the Suez Canal against the Turks, and their war finally began. The two sides skirmished across the canal, but there were no sustained engagements. New Zealand had its first soldier die in battle, and several Turkish soldiers were captured. In February 1915, General Birdwell advised the men they were not yet sufficiently disciplined to go to Europe. The disheartened troops returned to Zeytun, where they continued training and sightseeing as before.
We climbed the tallest pyramid, only to find there were hundreds of names etched in the stone blocks at the top. It seemed we all had the same idea. Everyone was restless, and it was no surprise when the volatile elements amongst the Australian and New Zealand units erupted. The red light streets of Cairo were turned into a shambles. Leave was cancelled, and fights broke out everywhere. A few days later, a sandstorm brought high winds that snapped ridgepoles and toppled tents. When thousands of locusts darkened the sky and we heard General Maxwell's gruesome tales of German and Turk atrocities, we knew it would not be long before we were facing the enemy once again. On the 12th of April, we paraded at midnight and marched off to the station led by the band. When we were safely at sea, the colonel outlined the part we had to play in the coming landing at the Dardanelles. The following day, we arrived at the Greek island of Lemnos and dropped anchor.
By now, the New Zealanders had been joined by reinforcements from home, including Ted Ryburn, who had stayed behind to sit his third-year law exams. Ahead of them, in the harbour at Lemnos, were dozens of ships with soldiers from Britain, France, India, and Australia. Most were troop transports, but there were also warships, minesweepers, and smaller supply vessels. It was here Will saw his first submarine and the first Allied aeroplane. On the 17th, after having rolled their blankets and waterproof sheets for transport, the men were issued their orders for the assault and heard the word Gallipoli for the first time. Initially, the Otago men were chosen for the first assault, but at the last moment, they were replaced by the Australians. Though they were disappointed, the men knew this battle was not like the skirmishes over the canal, and that sooner rather than later they would be able to prove their worth.
Not long after we cleared the heads, I heard what sounded like big guns firing. The Australians landed at 4 a.m, and we could hear the fight, the cheering and the like. When we were going in, we met 6 boatloads of wounded going to the hospital ship, and a lot more were on shore waiting to be taken away. A dead man was lying where we landed, with another lying further along and 2 more together. Blue Jacket and an Australian. I saw more after this, but that was my first introduction to such a sight. It was very hard and hot work scaling the hills. At almost every stop, blood drops were visible. From our resting spot, we could see the bodies of the machine gun men who were killed as they landed. As the shrapnel burst, all of us involuntarily rammed our faces into the earth. We were supposed to be the reserves.
We lay until dark, unprotected from the bursts of shrapnel directly over and in front of us. There would be a blinding flash overhead, a crashing report, and then the whistle of pellets. At dark it stopped, and we crawled out of the hollow we had scratched in the ground and entrenched. Part of our bank fell in on us and we had to haul one cobber out, but we soon got wise and knew exactly when and when not to sink into Mother Earth for shelter.
In the morning, they were told 17,000 British troops were on the other side of the Turks, working their way towards them.
The Australians continue to lose very heavily and are able to progress very little. A good many bayonet charges were made yesterday and trenches were taken, but owing to the stink of the dead, they could not stay in them. We had the news passed on to us tonight that 4,000 Indian troops have landed here and that the warships have forced through the Narrows. General Hamilton sent a message of praise to all of us, saying that the way we have fought puts us on par with our brothers in Europe.
The following day, the New Zealanders regrouped. The only water they had was what they had carried ashore, and they were very thirsty as they frantically dug trenches and filled hundreds of sandbags in an effort to provide protection against shrapnel and snipers, both of which continued to extract a deadly toll.
Water is scarce. We had to dig a hole and wait until it had drained enough to fill our bottles. 6 men have been shot here at this post, and another man was killed today. Our chaps have made some fine bayonet charges. Lieutenant Cowan went into one with a shovel and bashed in a German officer's head. He was killed coming back.
Anzac Cove soon became littered with stores and equipment, all of which had to be manhandled up narrow paths to the bivvies and trenches built into the steep-sided valleys and cliffs higher up. Sudden shots from snipers were now commonplace and treated with understatement and laughter.
Just now in our trench, Durrant was sitting down and received a bullet in his face.
I wish New Zealand people could see their boys now.
Its course has been diverted, but it had sufficient force to snip a piece of skin off and draw blood, then strike another chap on the leg.
I'm in a hole with my head on one side and feet in a correspondingly small hole in the other. Bullets have been pouring all morning, mostly from snipers, and dirt pulls down on us continually. Unshaved, grubby in the extreme. We are quite happy enjoying a joke at the expense of a man who is going off because his equipment is shot to bits. This little lot should be over soon. This is the 6th day of the battle, and we must be pushing on.
Ryburn was unwittingly echoing the thoughts of those in command who felt it imperative the troops push the Turks back over the ridges to the other side of the peninsula. On the 2nd of May, the Otago Battalion and one from Western Australia took part in what has become known as the Battle for Baby 700. The plan was for the Australians to attack the Turks from the most forward position of the Anzac line, while under the cover of darkness, the 800 men of the Otagos were to come up an adjacent gully and go over the top of the ridge. The Otagos were held up by unfamiliar terrain and snipers in the narrow gully. By the time they arrived, the Turks were waiting and opened fire with everything they had.
I have found it one of the worst experiences to be inactive by bullets ripped through the bushes all around. You wonder how in the world you dodged them.
Of the 800 Otago men who went up the gully, only 200 returned physically able to continue fighting. Half of Will Anderson's Southland Company were killed or wounded or left behind. Ted Ryburn was one of the men caught out in the open and unable to crawl to safety until the following day.
I will trust to memory for that lot. Don't think I shall forget it.
Will Anderson wrote in his diary that it was a night of slaughter, and there were few left alive to disagree. Despite their depleted numbers, 5 days later, the Kiwis were shipped down to Cape Helles to take part in the Second Battle of Kritha.
Shortly after 5 o'clock, an advance was made all along the line. We had to go across an open field which proved to be a death trap being commanded by machine guns. Here many fell. The dead and wounded lying like mushrooms. Reinforcements came forward, and though we sent a message back, they evidently had not got it in time to stop them from crossing the bullet-swept area. And all we could see was them getting mown down.
Ted Ryburn had somehow managed to get ahead of his company and ended up sheltering in a store shed watching the heavy artillery bombardment of the hills, unaware of what was going on behind him.
Met a couple of messengers sent out for news who said the company was waiting back in the gully. Made my way there and found there had been numerous losses. Helped to bury a sergeant who had been shot through the head just before he reached shelter. Dead and wounded littered the ground where there had been the charge. Nothing could be done for the latter as stretcher bearers had not got up. New Zealanders scattered all over the country, and it was great to hear the admiration the Tommies had for them. New Zealanders who got lost that day simply joined the nearest units and charged with them. saw a lot of the oft-described horrors of the battlefield in that one night. We could hear the wounded out in front and were powerless to assist most of them.
The men remained at Cape Helles for 2 weeks, building roads at night to help move the big guns forward. It was regular army life and a relief from the constant shrapnel and sniping at Anzac Cove. All too soon they were back and living once more with the black plagues of blowflies, basic sanitation, poor food and the ever-present stench of bodies left to rot in the sun. On Monday, the 24th of May, an armistice was arranged with the Turks for the collection and burial of the dead. Though for men like Anderson and Ryburn, who had lost so many mates, there was little regard for the enemy and no desire to see them up close before hostilities resumed.
Settling into trench life again. No view beyond clayey walls. This valley has a ridge down the centre, absolutely honeycombed with saps and trenches. Are more than 6 feet below the surface in some places. There are more rumours. The one about our going home is very persistent. Turks are also supposed to be dying in hundreds of fever, etc., etc.
Over the next few months, there were countless attempts to push forward, but there were no significant breakthroughs.
About 150 volunteers from Canterbury and Auckland formed an assault party on a piece of trench that was wanted to complete our position. It was only 20 yards away. They captured it with only 2 casualties, but next morning were driven out by bombs and lost heavily. Same thing attempted 9 times before, I believe, with the same result. Position is that both sides' trenches are fairly easily taken, but cannot be held.
Back in New Zealand, the long list of casualties from Gallipoli became available in May, causing a rise in the recruitment of reinforcements and the frenetic gathering of funds for various projects to support our boys. As uncensored letters arrived from the front, it was obvious the war was not the grand show so many had imagined it to be, but that idea persisted, and 3 months after the initial Gallipoli landings, a soldier correspondent writing from Anzac Cove for the Otago Daily Times reported, "We are splendidly fed for active service conditions, and while things are not too busy, it seems just like a big picnic. Because it is such a pretty little spot with small birch scrub growing all over the cliffs, and on the flat in front of us, there are acres covered in bright red poppies." The reality of bully beef and biscuits, constant danger and the ever-present stench of death was deemed unsuitable for the readers of the Otago Daily Times.
Lack of appetite, loss of weight, and energy are not recognisable as an illness here except to the sufferer. I've slimmed down so that I can make my fingers span my arm above my elbow, but I still have sufficient strength for every task.
Soon winded, our weary, perspiring way over the ridge down our old rest gully and along to beach. Camped on allotted ground on hillside just as we were. Went to sleep.
Finally, in July, the decimated Otago battalion was sent to Lemnos for a rest. They expected to stay a week, but within 2 days, they were ordered back. While on leave, Ted Ryburn became ill and was admitted to hospital on the island. When he returned several weeks later, he learned of the great battles, Forlorn Pine by the Australians, and Chunuk Bear by the Wellington Battalion.
I left the company nearly full strength, and the 6th reinforcements came after that. But instead of numbering 230 to 240, there were only 34, nearly all commanded by a promoted sergeant. Hutton imparted to me the astounding news that we, together with perhaps 2 more, were the sole survivors of the main body of the 4th Otago's.
Will Anderson was wounded in the bloody August offensive as his company moved up a gully in support.
It seemed to me that we were being sniped at by a machine gun with a much-worn barrel. I glanced at a chap facing me, and a round spot about the size of a shilling appeared fair between his eyes, and a great rush of blood drenched my tunic and tools. With blood oozing between my fingers, I carried on with a pick until I finished a stroke with my right arm alongside my leg. The same type of wobbly bullet went through, both carrying away a lot of flesh. Loose ends of a severed tendon in my arm were left dangling, but weren't long shrinking out of sight. Its impact was like a sledgehammer coming down on the anvil, and it nearly stunned me.
Anderson walked down to the beach and was loaded onto the British hospital ship Delta.
The decks were covered with wounded. My hands were still bloodstained. The blood caked and dried and then divided like sun-baked mud, and I passed the time by levering off each segment with my fingernail. An orderly gave me my first clean-up. After having a look at the abundant accumulation of festering discharge from the wounds, I was assigned a cot below decks. About 50 men were buried at sea between Lemnos and Alexandria, but for the not badly wounded like me, it was heaven on earth. By the time their cargo of wounded were unloaded at Alexandria, the medical staff themselves were certifiable as patients. We had taken all they could give and more.
A month later, the Otagos had 4 weeks' leave on Lemnos.
This holiday is not going to have the desired effect. We can now get a wash, have a fairly decent feed, sleep almost comfortably. But there is something the men have lost that they are not regaining. It's not morale. They do anything they've done before, perhaps better. They haven't lost heart, but they've lost interest in things in general. That's not exactly the right term, but it's pretty close. The reinforcements are keen, desperately anxious to get over to the other side. They chafe at the delay, but over and over again, I've seen an old hand half-heartedly smile to himself and tell them they'll be there in any amount of time. As far as one can see, after a month here, we will go back in practically the same condition as we left. Tired. Tired to death.
Anzac troops were withdrawn from the Gallipoli Peninsula on the 19th of December 1915, with no loss of life. This podcast was written by Brockenhurst RSA Scholarship recipient Robin Anderson. The memories of Will Anderson were taken from personal diaries and writing of William Anderson, and voiced by Jack Milner. The words of Ted Ryburn were voiced by Henry Warner and based on the personal diaries of Eric Middleton Ryburn, which are located in the New Zealand National Archives and in the Imperial War Museum in London. The narration was voiced by me, Mark Aldridge. Special thanks to Roz and Di and the members of St Nicholas Parish Church, Brockenhurst, Lorraine Maguire, the Christchurch Historical Society, and the Twin City Committee from Christchurch, Dorset, for their assistance and support.